Yeah, you could get.
Oh,
yep, exactly.
Oh,
time to go to work. Apparently,
chitter chatter. Holy cow!
Oh, jeez. Oh, jeez.
Hey everybody, it's Kai. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. None of us, as we like to say, is as smart as all of us on this podcast.
Exactly. We especially like to say that on Tuesday because that is the day that we throw up the flag and ask for help for a deep dive into a single topic. Today, that topic is employment. Today, just a little thing. We're just going to tackle this small thing today. Employment in America, how it's changing.
You might have heard that.
Kind of a thing.
Yeah, it's kind of a thing. And it's changing a lot, right? There's outsourcing. And this is a phrase you're going to hear in a minute in the interview. There's people at scale, right? Labor as commodity is what's going on here in this economy. And it turns out, actually, there's a whole industry behind it.
This is very true. Apparently, we have recently learned in 2019, over a quarter of the world's largest employers did not just make or sell products. They rented out people to work for other businesses, as contractors, as gig workers, as whatever. And actually, there is this sense that increasingly, as companies start to realize that, you know, paying these pesky employees is really the problem with their business model, there could be entire companies soon with no employees outside of the C-suite.
So the question is, how did we get here? And then question number two is, where does it mean that we are going? Where we're going right now is an interview with Peter Ballinon-Rosen. He's a producer here at Marketplace. He and the team at our investigative podcast, The Uncertain Hour, have a new episode out about exactly this topic. Peter is the voice of that episode, and he's on the phone now. Peter, how are you?
Good. How's it going, guys?
Good. Hello. So look, I'm going to jump right in here with both feet. I love this phrase that I heard in this podcast, people at scale. That's what really is going on in a lot of corporate America today.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's been this kind of seismic shift in how we're thinking about workers in some companies, where people and these companies are looking at the people who provide labor of them as another commodity that they can go out and buy at scale. Like you might think about office supplies like pens or like cardboard, depending on what your business is. And it's this idea that you can kind of get a good rate if you're buying a lot of people at the same time at scale. And so that's where we have staffing agencies come in, all these temp workers, contract workers, a lot of the people who are kind of changing what employment looks like here in America.
Tell us about this concept that comes up in the reporting that you did, which is this, which appears to have led to a bunch of outsourcing, this idea of core competence management theory, which just sounds super boring, but apparently affects the way companies hire significantly.
Yeah, it is totally boring when you just hear those words, right? Core competency. It's jargon for the sake of jargon.
No offense.
But I did find this thing pretty fascinating, right? And so it's this business theory, core competencies, that was developed by these business philosophers, if you will, Gary Hamel and C.K. Prahalad. And core competencies ended up kind of being the answer to this problem they were trying to solve. This was back in 1990, and all of a sudden, these Japanese companies were dominating these key industries like consumer electronics and the car industries, right? So we had companies like Canon, Sony, Toyota, Honda. They were all of a sudden kind of taking over markets where U.S. companies had been competitive. And Gary Hamel and C.K. Prahalad were trying to figure out, wait, what? How did this happen? What's going on here? Because as Gary Hamel, who I spoke to, he saw that U.S. companies, as they were trying to stay competitive, they were really into kind of marketing, you know, new flashy ads or really dialing in into these specific end products to get people to buy them. But that wasn't totally working. So they set out to look at what these Japanese companies were doing, and they saw that they were doing something totally different. And this is kind of where core competencies comes in. They saw that these companies were taking specific competencies, these specific skills, and making them core to their business, hence the name core competencies. So Canon, one of these companies that was dominating, Gary saw that they had gotten really good at miniaturizing electronics, right? So they were competitive in calculators, cameras, and printers. Honda, on the other hand, was focused on making efficient powertrains for things from cars to lawnmowers. So we saw that they weren't really focused on any specific products, but they were really good at developing these certain kind of skills. And so he said that core competencies are technically a bundle of skills, technologies, or processes that can hit three specific categories. So they provide access to a wide variety of markets, they benefit the customer, and they're difficult for competitors to imitate.
So then how does that lead to a dramatic change in labor?
Sure. So if you can think about, hey, okay, my core competency is doing this one set of skills, right? Like we can look at Disney, right? Their core competency is characters, storytelling, running amusement parks, which they can deploy for toys, they can deploy for movies, they can deploy for cartoons. You're also looking at all these other things that are within your business that aren't part of your core, right? And so companies start taking this idea and not only IDing these things that make them really special, but IDing these things that don't make them quite so special. And right after this article was published where they outlined these core competencies in 1990, kind of the rise of the internet combined with these global trade policies meant that companies started outsourcing all sorts of work, right? We saw Detroit auto companies looking to other companies to make engine parts. These call centers popped up all around the world. And then also here in the US, there were these new armies of subcontracted janitors, cafeteria workers, security guards, warehouse workers all over the place. These companies saying, hey, you know, it's not part of our core competency to manage janitors. And they looked to outside companies to pick up those skills and functions.
So, Peter, let me ask you this. If a company's objective is to make money, and it makes money best by doing what it does best, whether it's semiconductors or innovative financing or what have you, why should it not outsource everything but what it's good at?
I mean, so we've seen this increasing kind of specialization of everything in these businesses. Right. And so you say, okay, I'm specializing on these one things. So let me hire in outside folks to do the rest. But actually, in this article where Gary Hamel is laying out that idea of core competencies, he actually includes this warning where he's saying, hey, outsourcing can actually be really dangerous for a company. Because once these types of skills are outsourced, it's really, really hard to bring them back in-house. So basically, you have to be really careful for what you rely on outside companies to do, because then you might kind of lose out on using those skills for new markets.
So the idea is you have maximum efficiency, but you have less control. Is that why it's sort of a potential negative? In addition to, of course, people not getting healthcare and benefits and full-time employment and, you know.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, from the company's perspective, right? If you can have these skills in-house and you're using them towards one single product that flops, you still have the ability to pivot and kind of do these to apply it to new markets. But if you are totally reliant on outside folks to do the creation of your products and have the skills that allow you to do those things, you're not going to be able to move as quickly and kind of be as nimble and get to new markets.
Here's the thing I don't get, though, right? It's all about, companies are all about doing what they do and doing it well. It's a little bit like Henry Ford and the assembly line, right? Henry Ford's job was to make cars. It wasn't necessarily to do HR and do labor contracts and all of those things. And so what's lost, I think, in the conversation that we're having is the business imperative of the core competencies, right? Because if you go to Jamie Dimon, he's going to say, we have to do financial services, right? If you're going to go to take your pick CEO, Elon Musk is a really good one, right? Notoriously focused on either space or electric cars. That's what they do. And that's how they change things.
Right. I mean, and we've seen people leaning into this, and there's kind of this whole industry that's cropped up for people saying, all right, you know, you just focus on your core, Elon Musk, just focus on your core, Jamie Dimon, we'll take care of the rest. So we have these new companies that have kind of made a whole business out of connecting companies with workers who aren't their employees. There's this thing called the employer of record, which can basically help set up companies to work with independent workers and without ever having to kind of bring them on in-house. And we've seen these talent marketplaces arise where companies can connect with freelancers. Even LinkedIn is hopping in on this, and they have their sets, I kid you not, it's called marketplaces to compete with places like Upwork. So we've seen these kind of new freelance workers kind of companies more and more are turning towards them. And even Microsoft, the owner of LinkedIn, has discussed enabling LinkedIn to pay LinkedIn customers to pay freelancers through their own digital wallet, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah. I talked to a company recently that sort of that is doing this with a blockchain-based solution but it's all about verifying high-skilled talent and connecting them with companies. So, and all of this, like, it is innovative, and it does in some ways give employees of all skill levels maybe this future flexibility, except for this one big American problem, which is healthcare and benefits.
Yeah.
Like, is there any, you know, is there any way to square that circle?
Well, some economists have said that the rise of contracting and companies kind of specializing is really helping to fuel income inequality. Because, right, when you have work that is contracted out, entry-level work, you kind of lose that access to kind of working your way up the company ladder, right? And so you have this one set of people with kind of stable jobs, sick days, decent benefits, who have traditional employment, and then this whole parallel society of people who are doing contract work with less job security, benefits, and pay. And the whole argument that companies who are really into this idea kind of put forward is that it's all about flexibility, right? People are willing to sacrifice their healthcare, their benefits for the option of not having a, you know, 9-to-5 tied to one employer job.
So what's so the analog here is the gig economy? I mean, is that kind of what you just said?
Kind of. I mean, but it's so much bigger than that, right? It's definitely gig work, but it's also temp work, it's also staffing agencies, it's also workers who work in industries where one day they'll go into work and say, hey, I'm an employee of company A, and the next day they'll be told, you know what, you're now working for this subcontractor, you're no longer part of our core competency. And so it becomes this kind of layering. I like to think about it as an onion. There's all these different layers between the worker and the business they're doing work for, and that business now, because there is another company in the way, they're able to say, hey, that's not my employee. I don't have the same responsibilities to them.
Peter Ballin and Rosen is a producer for Marketplace's Uncertain Hour podcast. You can hear his whole piece and, of course, the whole show wherever you like to download. Peter, thanks.
Peter, thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Take it easy.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Yeah, it's a good episode. It's a whole good series, actually, this year. Because work is changing in this economy, right? That's the thing. Work is changing. This is one aspect of it. And it goes back, as Peter and Chrissy say in this podcast, it goes back like 35, 40 years.
I know. And it gets into the wage conversation that we've been having on an ongoing basis. And I really do think that there is starting to be this sort of slow creep toward the idea of portable benefits, of benefit pools, of a way to, because really that seems to be the way to make it work. And then you have to figure out the worker protection part of it, which, of course, is not for nothing. That's a big one to try to tackle. But it is like this really evolving conversation. And it's obviously not going to slow down because companies think it's worth it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, totally.
So how do we make it palatable for everyone?
Right. That's the thing. You got to make it palatable and worth it for workers, right? And that is the challenge we've had in this economy since way, way years ago, you know?
Yeah, totally. But yes, it does seem better than being just plain old trapped in a regular job where the wages never go up for 40 years. Yeah. At least you might have more options. Yeah. But, you know, they leave you without health care. So, wah, wah. Yeah. Anyway, yes, very interesting, ongoing topic, super relevant. Give it a download. Tell us what you think. We're going to take a little break and then talk about the news. Send us your comments on today's show on the idea of work, on tying work to benefits. All of that is available to you by sending ideally a voice memo to makemesmart@marketplace.org. We'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
I kind of love that sting. All right.
I do too.
The news is upon us. What you got? Do you have two?
It always makes me think of the Beastie Boys. Let the beat. I do. Straight up have two. Okay. No shame in my game at all. They're not even related.
I love the way sometimes you try to dress it up, and so do I, and sometimes you don't. Sometimes we're just like, no, I got two.
Time,
screw
nope.
It. It's our podcast. We do what we want. Yeah.
The first one I just find fascinating. I don't even have anything, you know, trenchant or observant to say about it. I just think it is so interesting that we can't do infrastructure.
It's unreal.
Of all things.
It's unreal.
In this country. Yeah. And so, you know, the New York Times headline on this front today in the business section is, after stimulus, Biden to tackle another politically tricky issue, infrastructure. Strengthening the country's highways, bridges, and broadband networks has broad popular support, but Washington remains bitterly divided on the details. And now I know that infrastructure week became a big joke during the Trump administration because it never happened. But this story notes that even before that, President Obama had a really hard time getting big infrastructure projects moving. Yeah. There, you know, is expected to be all of this kind of political pushback and all of these things. And the story notes that Obama failed mainly because Republicans wouldn't do it, right? The Congress would not, the Republican-controlled Congress would not push this forward. And it just seems to be this sort of like ongoing, fascinating example of all of the ways in which we will be absolutely hamstrung economically if the bridges and the roads and the broadband networks don't work. I mean, it just is like, I know we have more examples than we can count of political inefficiency, political. I'm trying to even think
you're
of the strong
word. You're trying to be kind. You're trying to not use curse words. I hear you.
I really. Yeah. Thank you. You yes. see me. I'm yes. trying not to swear.
Yes.
But like, politics are breaking our country. They are holding us back. Full stop. And this is like this apparently now almost decades long example. Bridges, roads, broadband.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's amazing. I think the reason it became the meme during the Trump administration is because the president would come out and say, he would come out like once a month and he'd say, in 2 weeks, we're going to be out with a $2 trillion infrastructure plan. And we were like, oh, okay, great. And then it happened and we were like, oh, okay, great. And then like the third time it happened, we were all like, oh, it's infrastructure week. Yay.
Here we go. We're totally doing it now. Yeah. We're totally doing it. But this is a really interesting piece that points out that infrastructure fundamentally is political, or at least has been trapped in politics since the Obama administration, if not before. And that feels like maybe the place to start at chipping away here, because I don't know if you've noticed, but there's some crumbling.
Just a
some crumbling. There's a large digital divide, things of that nature.
Yeah.
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 And then just as a follow-up, I swear this will be fast.
Oh, sure.
But we talked about all those consumers in Texas who are being hit with massive, massive, massive power bills because they had variable rate plans. And today it was announced that the largest and oldest power cooperative in Texas is filing for bankruptcy because it offered fixed rate plans. So then it got a $2 billion bill from power wholesalers because of course, those Texas storms. So this fallout just keeps going. And now we're entering the kind of like bankruptcy and lawsuit stage. And it is just ugly. And may I remind you that it probably could have been mostly avoidable had Texas connected its grid to the federal grid and been able to access energy from other places when this happens.
It's the classic unintended consequences thing, right? Look out what happens when you deregulate and disconnect your grid. This is what happens. It's kind of bizarre.
And everybody's getting screwed except the guys who sold the natural gas. Right. And they went on TV and were like, we did great.
We had a field day. Me.
Something, something, eat cake.
Yeah, that's right. Something, something. Okay. Mine is, were this an ordinary podcast day, which is to say our daily day, I would make this my Make Me Smile. But it's newsy and Make Me Smile at the whole thing. President Biden announced today that Merck is going to help Johnson & Johnson make its COVID-19 vaccine, the one that got conditional emergency use approval the other day. Merck was not able to develop its own vaccine. It's going to use its manufacturing plant to make the Johnson & Johnson one-dose thing. President Biden's going to invoke the Defense Production Act to give that manufacturing process a leg up. This is flat-out good news. And for all that I was negative and wah, wah, wah yesterday on I have to manage my expectations, I cannot help but think we may be at some kind of inflection point on getting vaccines out to people. And that would be just,
we really, really are. Yeah. I really sincerely and truly believe that we are.
Okay.
I mean, they're talking about because of this manufacturing increase alone, and every day there's some new efficiency that comes out. Yeah. That this will mean a third of Americans can be vaccinated by the end of March. We are sincerely cruising. We're cooking with gas in the vaccine department now.
Yeah, it's really good news.
Yeah.
Really good news.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it for me, Molly. You guys hit it.
Love it. Good smile.
Yeah, moving along.
Your turn.
Hello, Molly and Connor.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
So, got a voicemail from Carrie in Arizona about the thing we were talking about last week about healthcare workers at vaccination sites and how happy and pleased they are to be doing that. So here's Carrie in Arizona.
I retired from family medicine in December of 2019, and I certainly didn't expect a pandemic to be part of my first year of retirement. I am now volunteering at a community hospital at their vaccine clinic. I work five-hour shifts. I try to work 20 hours a week. It's one of the hardest things I've ever done physically, but I absolutely love it. I'm on my feet for those 5 hours, walking around cars on asphalt, and my legs are very tired at the end of a shift, but I can't wait to come back for my next one. The patients are happy and grateful that we're there, and I am so happy to see all these shots going into all these arms. Thanks for everything you do, and keep making us smart.
There you go. Shots in arms.
I love
that. That's
awesome.
That's great. That's great.
I signed up to volunteer at one of the sites. I don't know if they're going to take me. They're probably going to see journalist on there and be like, no way. But it just seems like what a phenomenal.
That's awesome.
What a phenomenal thing. I know. I hope they take me. Take me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now, full disclosure, get your tissues. It is time for the answer to the Make Me Smart question I read ahead, which is, on this topic, what is something you thought you knew, but you later found out you were wrong about? Today's answer comes from Eric in Minnesota.
Something I thought I knew, but only today found out that I was wrong about, is that I thought I understood and knew the impact of what 500,000 lives lived and lost looks like. Earlier today, when my mom called me to let me know that my grandpa passed away, it really hit me, cycling between bouts of crying and reminiscing about memories of him schooling us in cribbage, calling out all the points we missed with a toothpick in the corner of his mouth and a grin on his face. They were talking about this and these kind of memories 500,000 times across the nation. Is really sobering and really impactful. I hope as a country we're able to repurpose the passion of these memories and fuel the vaccine rollout, better prepare us for the next pandemic or whatever the challenge is that awaits us around the corner.
Because there is going to be another challenge. That's the issue here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. Eric, I'm sorry for your loss. Thank you for calling us. And yes, we, you know, somebody was saying that 3 years from now, they hope we're not having the conversation about, remember that. Like, why aren't we remembering the pandemic? But I think we have so many millions of people, truly millions of people, because what do they say? Every person who dies leaves behind like nine people grieving them. And as an average, millions of people grieving who have suffered this personally in some way. And there's just no way to account for that collective trauma and no way to internalize it when it's such big numbers, but yeah, every single one of them is a bomb that went off in a family.
It's that thing that Biden said the other day when he did that memorial service for the 500,000 who have died. And he said, you know, remembering and honoring is the way to help heal. I mean, he said it more eloquently than that based on obviously his life experience, but that's what it's about, right? And so you have to remember. Yeah. And we cannot be in 3 years having a conversation where this almost didn't happen, you know, because look, we're distracted as a country by a zillion things, and we just need to not forget this.
I believe we are going to be a country in grief for a long time. Hmm. Yeah. On that note, that is it for today's show. It is a weird time because there are lots of feelings all the time. Mm-hmm. Don't forget to send your questions for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. Wow, it's already almost Wednesday.
I know, right?
MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. I don't know. Some days you live every day twice and other times it's like they never happen. Subject line, questions. We'll see you then. We'll see you tomorrow.
Yep. Make Me Smart, and nice lip smack there, Kai. Holy cow, what was that? Make Me Smart is produced and trained radio professional. I'm going to start this for the third time. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner does production stuff for us. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters and our smart speaker skills.
Today's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe, who is the reason that you won't even hear that lip smack. Mixed by Emma Erdbrink. Because
they might leave it in there. You never know. They might leave it in there.
Just you talking about it, Charlton would be like, absolutely not. That's unacceptable. It's gone. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The senior producer is Donna Tam. The executive director of On Demand is Sitara Nieves. What a team we have. What a team.
Gets it on the air 5 days a week. On the air, on the feed, whatever. Whatever.
It happens. Sometimes it just happens.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.